don't have time.
Good afternoon. Got that right. House Committee on Business and Labor. Like to bring to order. We're going to start off by carrying over House Bill 3209, carrying over House Bill 2857, carrying over House Bill 2169, carrying over House Bill 2191, and carrying over House Bill 2348. That, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3402.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that limits the hours that a Department of Corrections nurse can be required to work, and it applies to collective bargaining that occurs on or after the effective date.
Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the record before you give us your testimony.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42. This bill is pretty simple. It protects nurses working for the various jails and corrections facilities of our state by allowing them to limit the hours they can work in overtime situations. First and foremost, this is about improving patient, or in this case, inmate safety. As many of you know, when I'm not doing this, I work for the Oregon Nurses Association. Nursing, especially in jails, can be physically and emotionally exhausting. Over the years, I've heard from nurses of my union about the tough conditions and things that they experience working in these types of settings. Stories that would make your hair on the back of your neck stand on end. Treating people that have been involved with drugs, coming in high on meth, stabbing folks, shooting, folks brought in fresh from a crime scene and then having to triage them to a hospital because they're bleeding too much. You name it. Given the lack of housing for the mentally ill and the deeply drug and alcohol addicted people that often find themselves in jail, these nurses are dealing a lot with the front line of some of the very societal problems that we are always trying to grapple with around here. Yet they love it. Some of them, I think, have almost religious feelings about working in a corrections facility. But even these nurses have lives and families outside of the workplace. Mandatory overtime is a big problem. When it happens, it can upset the delicate balance that a nurse and her family set up around child care or taking care of animals or her spouse's work schedule. I know jails and our own corrections facilities will tell you that this bill will cost money. Limiting mandatory overtime will force them to staff better or contract with an agency or have more on-call nursing staff available to better prevent mandatory overtime. That's probably why these nurses were left out and not included when the Oregon Nurses Association first began raising this concern for private sector hospitals at least a decade ago. And we did a lot of work on this, too, in the 2015 long session. This is a standard for them, and it seems like those in the private sector, and we're only asking that that be extended to basically what's almost like working in an emergency room in a jail for these folks. Please know the bill still allows nurses to voluntarily work overtime, and many nurses do in the private sector, but they do it when they can make it work for themselves and their families, and when they know they're not too tired to perform their duties. And with that, that'll conclude my testimony. Let Representative Malmstrom share a few things with you and then take any questions.
Thank you, Chair Hovey and members of the committee. My name is Sherry Malmstrom, state representative from House District 27, representing Beaverton and parts of Southwest Portland. I am a registered nurse, have been so for the last 35 years, and I'm here today to provide testimony in support of House Bill 3402, which would increase protections for nurses working in the Oregon Department of Corrections. In my written testimony that I originally had prepared, I was going to discuss why I believe this is a critical piece of legislation. Then the nurses that had planned to take time out of their day to come and testify in support of this legislation were, ironically, called off to work today and can't be here. Instead, I would like to read two excerpts, one's from the testimony of Debbie Runyon, a Department of Corrections nurse, and one from Sergeant Dan Russ, President of the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. Debbie writes, I've been a nurse for 20 years and have to pass medication, write and interpret doctor's orders, give medications, and make fast life and death decisions. And you get impaired if you have to get up and work for 10 or 12 hours on a shift. We wouldn't want our nurses to practice impaired by substances or mental problems. What makes lack of rest, overwork, and exhaustion any different. We risk our nursing license, our health, and risk lawsuits for the state of Oregon if we cannot practice safely, not to mention the health of our patients. Debbie's points are reinforced by Sergeant Russ's testimony, who writes, our nurses are overworked, exhausted, and often face mandatory overtime assignments. HB 3402 would limit the number of hours a nurse could be required to work by DOC. This would not only ensure the safety and security of our nurses, but of the inmates as well. We also hope it will help recruit qualified nurses and retain them once they arrive. Far too often, they see the working conditions, the long hours, and the number of mandatory overtime shifts, and we cannot keep the nurses on our staff. The nurses who currently work at OSD perform an exceptional job, but they too deserve guaranteed limits on the number of hours that they're required to work. Chair Hovey and members of the committee, this is a good bill, and I urge you to support it. Thank you, and we'll take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Fahey.
I just have thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question about one of the, in Section 2, it says it provides an exception under number 4 for if a staff vacancy for the next shift becomes known at the end of the current shift or there's potential harm to assigned patients.
Right.
But it doesn't look like the other 1, 2, and 3 have that exception. So beyond the shift that the employee has agreed to work regardless of the length of the shift.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fahey, not having the bill in front of me, my recollection is that the bill is very similar to how it works in the private sector. And so basically the way that we worked it out with the hospital association is you get a one-hour grace period, and then they have to scramble and try to find somebody to come in those situations.
It even includes a nursing supervisor. There's always nursing supervisors, and they may have to step in until, you know, something else happens.
Okay.
And there might be somebody else coming up could answer that question.
Right.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony today. I'd like to call up Joe Basler and Joe Defoe. Good afternoon. Introduce yourself, please.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME. We represent about just over 170 nurses who work in Department of Corrections. That's not all the nurses who work in Department of Corrections. There are some other folks at other institutions we don't represent. And this has become a real big issue for us. Actually, last session, we got very close to a deal with the Department of Corrections to get the bill passed, and it didn't quite get it through in time. So we're bringing it back. I should say we did have two members who wanted to come today, Marla Jones and Sarah Rossi, both of which ended up having to work a mandated extra shift. So they couldn't make it today. That was not on purpose. I was a little disappointed. The nurses at DOC, they are exempted from the same statutes that apply to hospitals, but I think it's very hard to argue that their job is any less stressful or any less dangerous. And the fact that they are exempted just doesn't make a lot of sense. We have several testimony from our members talking about working an 8-hour shift, having to stay for another 8-hour shift, so 16 hours, and then the next day coming in and working another 16 hours. It doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen quite often. The biggest problems we see are at Coffee Creek, are the women's prison, where there's just a lot of overtime in general. It's a big problem. But then also, especially in rural Oregon, where our members are driving in an hour and a half into work sometimes. They end up staying 16 hours, and they have to drive another hour home. Then they have to turn around to come back the next day, and it's becoming really dangerous and really unsafe for those workers. So this is a major issue for a very small number of folks, but it's really important. We would really love, we know there's going to be a fiscal, so moving it to Ways and Means would be great, and then we can sort of talk about it there in terms of the overall budget. And if the Department of Corrections has any changes they need to make, because it is a hospital is different than a prison, we'd be willing to sit down and have those conversations. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Hovey and Vice Chair and committee members. My name is Joe Defoe. I'm the Health Service Administrator for the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm also a registered nurse for about 27 years. I agree with everything that's said. I understand personally and professionally what it's like to work excessive shifts, and we want the wellness of our staff to be a priority. In our current operations, it is very different than a hospital setting. So we do have to go back to the table, work with our advocate partners, and figure out a way to bridge that gap and make sure our staff are well and our patients are well cared for. The current bill as is would make it difficult for that because there's such a difference between a hospital setting and our work environment. But I do have confidence that we can come back to the table and figure this out and keep our patients safe and our staff well.
Thank you. Questions? Well, thank you very much. I do note that I saw this bill, and I've seen this issue come before the legislature a couple of times before, and it doesn't seem like it's getting solved very quick. I know it's a fiscal issue, but I'm really concerned about the policy, you know, not being addressed. So it'd be my intent to send this back down to Ways and Means again, and maybe we can figure something out. So thanks a lot. We do have another question.
Thank you, Jolie. Do either of you know it sounded like the one-hour grace period. It looks like in the bill it only applies to one of the four situations, so I wasn't sure whether that was intended or not.
I believe Representative Nose is right. I think it's the situation where you're having to work right after your current shift, and there's a sudden vacancy. The other situations are also like not having to do extra overtime in consecutive days, and so it wouldn't apply as much. So I think it's really just specifically towards there. That's I think Representative Nose.
Okay,
got it.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot for being here today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I'm going to close the work session or public hearing on House Bill 3402. Very far away. And with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3264.
Chair and committee members, this is a measure that requires public contracting agency to pay a certified small business contractor within 15 days of receipt of the invoice or by the date the payment is due, whichever comes later. It requires a contracting agency to pay interest of 1% per week on the amounts not paid promptly, and it creates a crime, which would be Class A misdemeanor, of knowingly supplying false information when the small business is certifying. Becomes operative July 1st, 2018. There are no amendments today.
Okay. And I know we're waiting for Representative Gomberg to join you, but I think he will be joining you as you speak.
Okay.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Members of the committee, my name is Janelle Bynum. I'm state representative for House District 51 here in Oregon. I'm happy to be here today to testify on House Bill 3264, which is my bill aimed at improving the turnaround time on contracting payments here in Oregon. I'll begin with what prompted me to introduce this bill and then speak more to the amendments that are on the way, but I wanted to note that the content of the bill has changed significantly since its introduction. In my experience as a small business owner, one of the most important things that leads to success and growth is having working capital. Without it, you can't meet your obligations, including payroll, insurance, license renewals, et cetera, as well as having cash on hand. So it's an important reminder that many fledgling small businesses are incredibly close to the line between success and failure. So often owners have loans to pay, work hours well beyond the typical workday to keep things afloat, and life is just different when you're a small business owner. But really, at the end of the day, having faster access to capital can make or break a business, and House Bill 3264 intends to help with that hurdle. So when you complete a contract, the lag time between the completion and payment hinders the real progression of the business. By requiring a prompt 15-day payment to contractors after the work is complete, we can help alleviate this burden. House Bill 3264, as originally introduced, would implement that 15-day time frame for contracting agencies to pay their invoices to businesses with 200 or less employees, and it was aimed at the state of Oregon. the amendments that are coming are going to narrow this bill substantially. It'll be implemented as a pilot program, which only applies to ODOT. And I just wanted to acknowledge that our ODOT director stepped up to the plate on this and felt like it was important to support small businesses. And so it'll be targeted with their architecture and engineering contracts. We'll be lowering the threshold to qualify as a small business to 50 employees or less and keeping that 15-day time frame to turn around invoices. So I'm grateful to ODOT for recognizing the importance of this issue and its impact on our small businesses. Just to close out, I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation on how our state can help small businesses. And so the amended version of 3264 will start us down that path in relation to prompt payments, real small business support, equity in state contracting, and just a real impact on the small businesses in our state. So I hope I have your support in moving forward with that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast. I apologize for slipping in a little bit late, but I'm sure, as you all know, it's deadline days, and some of us are expected to be in three places at once. I am very pleased to be here today to support the good representative with House Bill 3264. Actually, when I saw this bill had been introduced and read a little bit of detail on it, I understood precisely what the good representative was trying to get at, because it's something that my small business deals with all the time. We get calls from a variety of different kinds of governmental agencies or units that are looking to purchase product from us, and they want to use purchase orders. And there was a time when we were happy to accept those opportunities because we needed the business and we wanted to provide good service in response to people that were interested in the products we offered. What we learned is more often than not, it just took forever to get paid. It took forever to get paid. And we'd be chasing after these invoices, and we'd be making phone calls to offices that had never heard of us because it had been so long that the people that placed the order had just simply moved on. We finally got to a point in our small business where we stopped taking purchase orders from governmental units or governmental agencies because it was more trouble than the profit was worth. That's a very sad scenario, Mr. Chairman, and I'm glad that the good representative has brought forward a proposal that would put Oregon on the right track toward addressing this kind of problem on behalf of small businesses. And I'm particularly pleased that ODOT has offered to step forward with a pilot project so we can really zero in on the fine-tuning of this, make it work, and then take that pilot project forward.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Maybe we should have Matt Garrett come up and join you. Since I see him back there, and he did sign up.
He's so quiet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Matthew Garrett and have the privilege of being the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm not sure I can be any more eloquent than the two representatives and what they stated here. Had the privilege of working with Vice Chair Bynum on the conceptual amendment she spoke to, and again, we think there's an opportunity at the Department of Transportation, specifically in the discipline of architecture and engineering, to better inform this overall conversation. Prompt payment, the implications to small business, and the inability to grow small business. This is a big deal. It reflects in my portfolio, and I think we have an opportunity to inform that. So we will walk through the discipline. We will see how it plays itself out. We will come back to you and your colleagues to report on the pilot, what worked, what didn't work, and then we'll move forward or not based on that information. So we look forward to continuing the conversation, refining the opportunities, and informing this overall conversation that's critical to small business in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Hurd.
Quick statement of appreciation. So I just wanted to say thank you to both the representatives for bringing this bill forward, and thank you to the director for your willingness to participate. Prompt payment to small businesses and any business for that matter is a big deal. Past experiences has been unpleasant at times for me, in particular with some federal payment that was due to my company. So I can relate to 100 plus days out after the payment is due. So thank you.
Thank you very much, and Director Garrett, thank you for taking on this. I think it will be extremely informative to see how that works. Mm-hmm. So looking forward to the pilot project and its conclusion so we can have a more discussion about this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much.
committee, and on 3264, we do have an amendment that's currently being drafted. We didn't get it back for this meeting, but we'll be carrying this over to have it after we get the amendment. So, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3264. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3170.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is the first time you're hearing about this bill. It is a committee bill. It extends collective bargaining rights to certain faculty members of public universities with an academic rather than administrative focus. It applies to bargaining units certified or recognized on or after the effective date, and it applies to agreements entered into or renewed on or after the effective date. The Dash 1 amendment specifies that the provisions do not apply to collective bargaining agreements renewed on or after the effective date.
So we have Mark Novak and Sarah Drescher.
That's correct.
If you'd introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Drescher. I'm an attorney with Tedesco Law Group. We are a labor law firm. We represent unions across Oregon. And we represent unions at Oregon's public universities, including the American Federation of Teachers, United Academics at the University of Oregon, and the Graduate Teaching Fellows Federation. Under the current law, supervisors are excluded from collective bargaining. They cannot join a union. But problematically, determining who is a supervisor is a complex analysis that has to be conducted on a case-by-case basis. Currently, a supervisor is someone who has the authority to hire, transfer, suspend, lay off, promote, discharge, reward, or discipline other employees, or responsibly direct them, or adjust their grievances, or effectively recommend sex action, but only if the exercise of that authority requires the use of independent judgment. Now, I can tell you from trying several of these cases, determining who is a supervisor is not clear-cut. You don't get to take an entire category of employees and say, they're supervisors. You have to take them one by one and look at each individual job duties to determine that. Now, I represent OSEA, the Oregon School Employees Association. So I can tell you, in the K through 12 public employee setting, it's a little bit easier. Principal, supervisor. Teachers, classified employees are not. But when you come to higher education faculty at Oregon's public universities, this analysis is daunting. Because unlike traditional supervisors, faculty at Oregon's public universities, they focus primarily on teaching, research, and outreach. They have some supervisory duties, but only some of them, and those supervisory duties are incidental, and they're often exercised only for a limited period of time. So, for example, research faculty may exercise supervisory duties when grant funding for a research project provides for research associates or research assistants who help them with the research in the lab. However, unlike the traditional supervisory relationship, that relationship between faculty and research assistants or associates is a collaborative relationship. They're working together in the lab, in the field, producing groundbreaking research. And unlike traditional supervisory relationships, that supervisory relationship ends when the research project ends or when the grant funding runs out. So those supervisory duties can come and go. That is not like a traditional supervisor position. Now, I know personally how problematic it is to classify faculty as supervisors, because in 2012, my firm represented the faculty at the University of Oregon when they sought union representation. The University of Oregon objected to the inclusion of numerous faculty members in the bargaining unit on the basis that they were all supervisors. And the parties, my firm and Harang Long, spent months and a lot of legal fees arguing over whether dozens of individual faculty members were supervisors. And we had to take them one by one, look at each one's individual job duties. And the issue ultimately became so complicated, we removed it from the whole Employment Relations Board process. We created a separate dispute resolution process just to resolve ongoing questions of whether faculty members were supervisors. House Bill 3170 would clarify the definition of supervisor so that faculty at Oregon's public universities with ancillary supervisory duties are not denied the right to join a union and collectively bargain. The bill will avoid that time-consuming, expensive litigation required to determine on that case-by-case basis whether faculty members are supervisors. And it will also avoid that need to continuously add and remove members from a bargaining unit depending on whether those supervisory duties come and go. Now, importantly, this bill will still exclude traditional supervisors. So if you look at the bill, it clarifies that supervisors who are traditional supervisors are still excluded from bargaining units. That means administrators, such as the president, vice president, the provost, deans, heads, those equivalent positions will still be excluded so that we are more aligned with what traditional supervisors are. I want to point out the Oregon legislature has made similar clarifications to this definition of supervisor in the past for both nurses and firefighters, both of which my firm also represents. And like nurses and firefighters, Oregon's faculty at public universities are this unique category of employees. Again, their primary job duties aren't supervising. Their primary job duties are research and instruction. And they shouldn't be denied the important job protections that come from being able to join a union simply because they exercise some limited supervisory duties. So again, this bill that you have in front of you is consistent with the legislative history. Let me close by saying that House Bill 3170 is simply good public policy for Oregon. It will extend important legal protections to faculty at Oregon's public universities, and this is particularly crucial now in a time when we need to protect scientific inquiry. Because if we can't protect the jobs of those of our most scientific minds in Oregon conducting the most important research in Oregon, then we have a lot to lose. It will reduce the litigation and legal costs, and it will safeguard valuable research projects that promote Oregon and local economies. I urge you to support this bill. I'm open to any questions you may have. Thank you.
Go ahead, Ian.
My name is Mark Novak. I'm a tenure track assistant professor in the College of Science at Oregon State University. As for my position description, I spend approximately 45% of my time teaching.
Can you move the mic just a little bit closer to you?
45% of my time conducting research and approximately 10% of my time providing service to my university, my department, and my profession. I'm a marine and freshwater ecologist by training. My lab studies the complex network of connections that link species to one another in an ecosystem. Our work is motivated by the pressing need to understand and predict how species and their populations respond to perturbations of their food web, be it to environmental change, conservation or management actions, or harvest. For example, much of my current work seeks to inform so-called ecosystem-based management, whereby the direct consequences of harvest on a given target fishery, for example, are considered jointly with the indirect ripple effects to other species in the system. It's like trying to understand the effect, the negative and positive effects of harvesting Dungeness crab on the rockfish and salmon fisheries and all everything that's in between that we care about. I've been in my position for approximately 5 years, almost 5 years, and as such will be soon evaluated for tenure and promotion by my university's administrators and colleagues. Having my promotion and tenure denied would be tantamount to losing my lifelong dream job. I consider myself extremely lucky to be doing what I do, particularly so because I'm surrounded by a wonderful community of students and supportive colleagues, and because I'm living in the Pacific Northwest. My lab currently includes a postdoctoral scholar and a lab manager, also known as a faculty research assistant. The success of my research program and that of my students relies on the expertise, support, and mentoring these individuals provide, as does my ability to procure funding from the National Science Foundation and other such agencies and foundations. However, according to current law, my official supervisory role with respect to these individuals would bar me the option of joining a union. I estimate that this applies to approximately 88% of the professors in my department. Without the passing of House Bill 3170, our collective bargaining rights would switch on and off each time our supervisory status changes. For me, this would occur on a very frequent basis because of the grants on which postdocs and FRAs are supported have a typical lifespan of 1 to 4 years. So if the past 5 years are indicative of the future, then I will likely switch status no less than 3 times in the next 5 years. House Bill 3170 would avoid such absurdity, including academics like myself, in the list of professions for whom the simplistic designation of supervisor status is ill-suited. I consider myself to be extremely fortunate in having landed my faculty position. In fact, I'm still more fortunate than that because my wife, a paleontologist, also landed a tenure-track assistant professor position at OSU. We truly consider ourselves to have been struck by lightning twice. That said, there are a number of aspects of our positions as teaching and research faculty, including improvements to family leave policies, increasing research productivity through improved lab conditions, and further strengthening support for science and science education, which I and my colleagues are eager to help the university resolve. I see collective bargaining rights to be a key pathway forward for helping my university address these and other challenges. So in a nutshell, I urge you to support House Bill 3170 precisely because of how much I love my job, how much I love being at OSU, and for the opportunity it presents to better my communication with my administration. I wish for the option of joining a union to help find solutions to the issues that affect both my personal and professional life. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the testimony. Questions? Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the things that I do in my profession is I'm a human resources consultant, so I help companies try to answer this question of, is someone a true people manager or are they more of a process manager? Do they actually have direct reports or are they just managing someone's, directing their day-to-day tasks? And as you acknowledge, it's a really tricky thing, and that's oftentimes it's not black and white. But some of the things that I tend to look at are, does someone have higher authority? Do they have fire authority? Can they determine someone's compensation? And can they discipline or put on a performance improvement plan? Those are four of the big things that I look at. So can you talk a little bit about the research faculty and the research associates they bring on a grant, as the example you gave, mm-hmm. and whether or not in that situation they have higher, fire, pay, or disciplinary authority?
Chair Holvey, Representative Fahey. The answer to that varies depending on where you go
okay.
and which individual faculty member you're looking at, what the research project is. And that's sort of part of the problem, frankly. Is it possible that a faculty member supervising a research assistant in their lab could say, you know, you really messed this up, you're fired? It's possible. However, keep in mind, these are employees of the university, right? The employer is the university. It's not that faculty member. So when we look at, as you know, who has that authority, that ultimate authority to set policies and employment policy, that's the university. So that's why I like to think of it as the supervisory authority is really ancillary and it's very limited to supervising perhaps just that research on that project. Did you have anything to add to that?
No, that sums it up perfectly. I feel more myself more as a mentor and supervisor in the sense of informing others of the actual decision.
Thank you. Representative Barreto, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So right now, the faculty or the staff, the president of the university would then do the bargaining with the unions, I think, on the staff, wouldn't they? Is that currently how that works?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, whoever is doing the actual collective bargaining also varies by university, but yes, typically the president, human resources, their attorney, who you see at the bargaining table is up to the university to decide, but yes, that would be the management. We call them administrators sure. who are on the other side.
So in this bill, how does that model work out when the president is also part of the union? Who do they negotiate with then?
So Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, actually the president is excluded. So if you take a look at the bill itself, subsection A says that supervisory employees now include the president, vice president, provost, vice provost, dean, associate dean, assistant dean, head or equivalent position. Yes. Those individuals, those positions are still supervisory. They are not included in the bargaining unit. Those are still the people on the other side. So there are the people on, when I say the other side, I'm used to coming to a bargaining table. So there are the people who are on the other side of the bargaining table bargaining for the university now, and that does not change with this bill. What we're looking at are these people who, frankly, their positions, you know, research faculty members at U of O, for example, those positions are already in the bargaining unit, okay? The problem is that individuals are plucked out okay, and said, you're a supervisor, you're a supervisor, you're a supervisor, you don't have the right to join the rest of your colleagues. These positions are already in the bargaining unit. Individual employees, particularly research faculty, have been removed because they're told, you're supervisors, because you supervise these folks in the lab. That's the problem we're looking at. This is not traditional supervisors. This is a special category like charge nurses, like battalion chiefs for firefighters. And if you look at the law, those are the two exceptions this legislature has made. And faculty fall exactly into that category. They are not a traditional supervisor. They have a role of research and instruction, and it just so happens because they do such great research, they might have members in their lab that they are responsible for some day-to-day operation. Anything to add to that?
Okay, thank you for that clarification. I was reading this wrong.
No problem.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3170. And let's open up a work session on House Bill 3008.
Committee heard this bill back on March 8th. It's a bill that comes to you from Representative Malmstrom. It prohibits an employer from requiring the employee to submit false information related to their hours worked or their pay received. Establishes a private right of action, allows the court to award actual damages of $1,000 per violation, and to award attorney fees and costs as well as injunctive relief. Allows the commissioner of Boley to assess civil penalty not to exceed $1,000 per violation. There is now a -1 amendment before you that clarifies that the employer may not require the employee to create, file, sign their wage and hour records when they know that that information is false. Clarifies that the court and the Commissioner Boley shall count each pay period in which the violation occurs or continues as a separate violation. And on the -1 amendment, there is no revenue impact and there is a minimal expenditure impact.
Thank you. Representative Kinnemer.
Yes, so in the -1 amendment comes from, if I may ask?
It was a committee amendment. It was suggested by Betsy Earls. And she talked to me about it, and I agreed to draft that amendment, though I don't see her here at the moment. So I guess she can't. You can ask her about it later, I guess.
Thank you.
Representative Barreto. Yeah,
Mr. Chair, we did talk to Betsy yesterday, and she said she was putting this in, and I didn't know whether this was hers or not, so I texted her, and she said, yes, this is her amendment. So, thank you.
Usually we'll take a motion before we speak to the bill, so maybe we'll move on to a motion to adopt the -1.
Chair Hovey, I move to adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 3008.
Representative Bynum moves to adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 3008. Now, discussion? I think we already had it. Is there any objection to adopting the amendment? Seeing none, they're adopted.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 3008 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bynum moves House Bill 3008 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. although I strongly support the bill in the fact that employers should not be allowed to do this and should be punished for doing so, I believe it is already against the law to require this of employees, and I become weary of the layer after layer of legislation against employers, and I'm concerned that it's causing our state to be very toxic for employers. So I'm probably going to be a no because of that.
All right. Other comments? Seeing none, Kayla, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye. Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hurt?
No.
Representative Kenimer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 3008, the motion passes. It moves to the floor. Volunteer for a carrier on that bill.
Mr.
Oh. Thank you. Representative Malmstrom volunteered to carry that bill.
I think it's be volunteered.
We'll close the work session on House Bill 3008, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2975.
Committee members, this is another bill from Representative Malmstrom. You heard about it March 13th. This is the bill that allows the court to award $500 in statutory damages as well as reasonable attorney fees to the prevailing retail customer who brings an action against a vehicle dealer when there is a claim of fraud or fraudulent representation or there's violations relating to the vehicle code. There is now a Dash 1 amendment that makes some very technical clarifying language regarding the award of damages and attorney fees. There is no revenue impact on this measure. And I think we're waiting on the fiscal. I'm going to double check that.
Thank you. And do we have someone to speak to the Dash 1 amendment?
I think Mr. Young Walgen Kim.
Mr. Young Walgen Kim, maybe you could describe what the Dash 1 amendment does to House Bill 2975 for us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Hovey and members of the committee. Yes, the Dash 1 amendment to the bill really does not make functional changes to.
You need to introduce yourself for the
my
record.
My name is Young Walgen Kim. I'm an attorney in Salem. I represent consumers against car dealers. HB 2975 Dash 1 really makes no functional changes to the original bill. It just makes clarifications to the intent. So the intent of 2975 was to add to existing remedies already available under 822.030. But when we reread it, we realized that HB 2975 could be erroneously interpreted as limiting retail claimants' claim to $500 each. And that was not the original intent. And the Dash 1 amendment just makes it clear that it is, and it rather than replace a remedy that's already there, supplement it so that we can avoid needless litigation about the ambiguities.
Thank you. Are there questions? Not seeing any questions. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And
so there is no fiscal, we're waiting on the fiscal. There's no fiscal statement yet. So the committee, if they chose, could adopt the amendment and carry over the bill.
Let's go ahead and adopt the amendment. Chair Bynum.
I don't have a motion.
Chair Hovey, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2975.
Representative Bynum moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2975. Discussion? Anybody object to the amendment? Dash 1 amendment's adopted.
Chair Hovey.
We can't move it now, so we'll close that work session on House Bill 2975. Open a work session on House Bill 2356.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a committee bill. It is the bill for the debt buyers. It establishes requirements under which the debt buyer may bring legal action to collect the debt. There's a Dash 4 amendment that came in late this morning that's on OLIS, and I believe you're asking representative from DOJ to speak to it.
Correct. If we could have Cheryl Heemstra, please. And when did we hear this bill?
March 27th.
And let's have Rick Blackwell come up, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself and try to explain to us the journey, well, maybe not the journey, but what's in the amendment?
Happy to. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here today to walk you through the journey of House Bill 2356. So, first of all, thank you to all the stakeholders who have put a lot of hours into this bill. We have consulted with the Oregon State Bar, the Oregon Judicial Department, the Department of Justice, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the collectors, the debt buyers, and consumer advocates to get you the dash for us today. So, briefly, I'll just recap the issue we were seeing with debt buyers who are buying and selling a lot of this debt is that there were a lot of default judgments happening in small claims court where basically the consumer probably wouldn't understand that ABC debt buyer was connected to the original debt that was owed. So that's one of the main issues we're trying to address with the bill. There are three main parts to the bill. There's sort of the pleading section, the collection section, and the licensing section. So first for the pleadings, we wanted to make it clear to a consumer who is getting sued that this is connected so they would know to what the original debt was that they're being sued upon. So if you're filing a lawsuit, you have to list out who the original creditor was, what the name and address of the person who actually owns the debt now, the original account number if there was one, and detailed itemization that kind of shows the fees that have been added along the way. This will give the consumer more information and be able to identify what the original debt was. If the case goes to a default judgment, the debt buyer will have to attach an affidavit. And the affidavit says three things, basically, that we actually do own this debt. We have proof that shows the chain of title. So that we have the right debt buyer collecting on this debt. It says that this is not past the statute of limitations. There had been some problems coming up with what we call zombie debt, debt that's supposed to be dead but got sued on anyway. And then if they're asking for attorney fees, that they have the right to do so. So a promise to the court, a promise to the consumer that all of that is proper and in place. If that's not the case, if we find that, the affidavit was filed wrongfully, that not only is that perjury, that would be a violation of the act. So that's the pleading section. There is another part there connected with the pleading section about those documents that have to be attached. I'm going to call this the pause button, basically. A consumer can ask for those documents and put a kind of 30-day pause on the collection. That was a great idea, kind of through the compromises that we talked through with the debt collectors to give the consumer a right to get that information and kind of just put a hold on things so they could get that information. I will clarify for the record that once the debt collector or debt buyer produces those documents, then it's no longer a violation of that section once they produce it. So a consumer can't, try to play the system and keep on asking for it and keeps restarting that 30-day clock. We wanted to make sure that wasn't going to happen. So that's the pleading section. The collection section, primarily the changes we're making there are a new Q, R, and S starting on page 8 and going to page 9. These were heavily negotiated, but we got to a great place. Q addresses an issue that we were seeing where debt collectors would be collecting against debt that was already covered or should have been covered by Medicaid or the Oregon Health Plan. And so what we put in there is you can't do that. We did put an affirmative defense for the debt collectors. If they have an affidavit from, say, the hospital that charged off that debt, that this isn't covered by Medicaid or OHP, that will cover them. That's a reasonable belief on the part of the debt collector that this wouldn't be covered by Medicaid or OHP. Next is R. And R is going to help out a lot of consumers here. Again, it's the zombie debt issue of a debt collector can't file past the statute of limitations for these cases. S, and I have to get a little bit technical here. S addresses a case from 1992 in the Court of Appeals called Porter v. Hill. Porter v. Hill held that in order for the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act to apply, you needed to have a right. And if so, if you sued the wrong person, that didn't make the right exist, so therefore the act didn't apply. So it came out with this bizarre holding that said, if you sue the wrong person, it's not a violation of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. So what we're trying to do here is fix that holding by saying the debt collector knowingly collects, it's a violation if they knowingly collect without an underlying agreement showing that there was an original debt connected to this original creditor. So that's the intent with that fix. It does mirror a portion that's in federal law. I'll add that for the record as well. There also was a concern I want to address for the record that this might touch on commercial debt. I just want to clarify that it doesn't touch on commercial debt. The way we get there is, and bear with me here, a definition within a definition within a definition. So what we the dance here is debt buyer. In the definition of debt buyer, we include the definition of charged off debt. So a debt buyer includes those who purchase charged off debt. Charged off debt is debt that a creditor has written off. A creditor, as defined in the bill and as applies throughout the whole bill, is somebody who's buying, who is in consumer transactions. So it doesn't apply to commercial debt. It just applies to these things based upon consumer transactions. Finally, I wanted to clarify one more thing for the record. On page 10, there's it talks about the business records requirement here. And what we're trying to say here, the intent here is behind this requirement does not mean that a debt buyer must have a witness or an affidavit from the original issuer. It's just the records that the debt buyer has on file. So I just wanted to make that clear for the record as well. So that is Acts 1 and 2. Rick's here for Act 3 licensing.
Thank you. For the record, Chair Holvey and members of the committee, I'm Rick Blackwell, policy manager at the Division of Financial Regulation. When we were approached about having a regulatory piece to this bill, we made it clear that we wanted something sufficiently robust. So we took a look at, I suppose, the back catalog of some of the licensing programs that we run within DCBS. And sections 3 through 13 really reflect, I guess, our experience with other sorts of non-bank financial entities. So I'll be as brief as I can. Sections 3 are definitions. They're really patterned from other parts of our laws. We do rely on the definition of debt buying that's in 646-639, which is the one that Cheryl discussed here just now. And I'm glad I certainly didn't have to take on that, the creditor, commercial creditor. Section 4 is the general requirements to obtain a license as a debt buyer and then provides some exceptions for that requirement. The exceptions do have an exception in that the exemption is limited to the scope of work under the license. So that, for instance, if you are a third-party debt collector, that you can work with clients to collect debt, but if you buy debt for yourself, then you are subject to the law. So sections 3 through 13. Section 5 would be the application requirements. So we are looking for a set of information about corporate officers, history of the corporation. So, for instance, we've had some instances in other areas that we regulate where a corporate officer may turn around and have a different company or a different role within a company to evade licensing requirements. And so we ask for that kind of information to do our diligence. Section 5 also then requires us to make some findings about whether a license can be issued. So if the application's complete, that they've got certain errors and omissions insurance, and I can discuss that. I'll discuss that in just a minute. Bankruptcy filings and criminal convictions are clean and hasn't had orders taken against them by other states. So we really are trying to make sure that entities that have been in trouble elsewhere aren't moving here to continue activities for which other states have had a dim view of. Let's see here. Same in Section 5 also, the license is a one-year period, and this allows us to mesh with the multi-state license system that we use for mortgage brokers and bankers and some other non-depository licenses. That way, so every year the license would renew at a set period, just like, and we do run a lot of licenses like that on an annual basis. Subsection 6 of that allows us to suspend or revoke a license if they don't respond to allegations of complaints, if they intentionally violate state or federal law, or if they refuse to comply with the final order. So, for instance, if we issued a cease and desist order that tried to bar certain conduct which may be illegal or unlawful under the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, and there's just a simple refusal to comply. Section 6 is really administrative provisions, but I do want to point out that, like in for mortgage and other entities, we would like to have debt buyers use what's called a unique identifier. It's a number that's issued by the same multi-state system that we'll be using for licensing. It allows consumers to really look up the history of a debt buyer so that they can do some research on who's asking them to pay, see if they've had orders or other actions taken against them in other states. Section 7 is really about disclosures of significant events. We'd like companies to tell us when they've had issues like bankruptcy or problems in another state. And so that is just kind of a legal requirement to keep us informed as to what's going on with the company. Section 8 requires us by rule to set certain policies and procedures for the lawful collection of debts. This is where we'll have a very large, I believe, stakeholder work group with debt buyers, third-party collectors, and all other interested parties to make sure that we've got the right sorts of standards. But we're looking for whether folks are trained on debt collection practices, protection of sensitive consumer records, because there's a lot of information about debtors here that we would like to keep protected, how the complaint handling process works, procedures to withdraw lawsuits as appropriate, and also practices governing filing truthful affidavits. So we'll be definitely working with other parties to get a sense of like what's the most appropriate best practices we can put into law. So Section 9 is a series of prohibited practices by a debt buyer, essentially fraud or lapse of an errors, omissions, insurance policy, that sort of thing. Violations of state or federal law, fair credit reporting, telemarketing sales rule, which is something the FTC administers, and then state and federal ID theft laws. I'm going quickly, so if there's any questions, please let me know.
When you get done, we will.
Okay, thanks. Section 10 basically allows us to examine debt buyers as we would with other programs. Because we may be working with a lot of sensitive consumer data, that data is exempt from a public records disclosure, but the rest of it, such as an exam report, would be disclosable upon request. Section 10 also contains a couple of other items that I'd like to point out. Sub 5 has what we're calling a doorway, which is a way to have a unique orderly process for DOJ or DCBS to act without stepping on each other's toes or having us work at the same time to the detriment of a debt buyer. So we will work together to make sure that if one entity, one agency is not, declines to act and the other one is able to. So it'll be kind of a whose turn is it, but it'll be set out in law. This Section 10 also contains a clause that we can work with and consult with certain nonprofit trade associations in order to make sure that our law is strengthened and that we're in consultation with them on best practices. Again, it's really part of my job in order to make that happen anyway, so I'm definitely happy to put it into law. Section 11 would give us certain enforcement tools available, cease and desist orders I mentioned earlier, which is a way for us to say, please stop what you're doing. It's a bit like an administrative restraining order, basically. Civil penalties, and then also we could order the return of all payments back to a debtor if we find that there was violations of the law. Section 12 preempts local regulation of debt buyers. This is something that's fairly common in some of our laws, like banking, where you don't have local banking departments examining a bank. And then finally, 13 is a general rule authority for us to fill in the blanks as needed to implement Sections 3 through 13.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I have two questions, and we'll start with one, but answer however you want. So for those of us non-lawyers who did not stay at Holiday Inn and pray God never have to go through Section 29 or whatever it was and understanding things, really two questions. First one, it's unanimous. There's no question. The legal advice on this is that there is a difference between commercial debt and consumer debt. This does not affect and shall not affect commercial debt.
Chair Hovey, Representative Evans, correct. This shall not affect commercial debt.
Excellent. Second question, follow-up real quick. Just for the record, we won't need an amendment, don't need an amendment, never should have had an amendment that says commercial is different than consumer.
Chair Hovey, Representative Evans, correct.
God bless you. Thank you. That's all I have. Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have two questions, too, if I may.
Sure.
The first one is I understand there will be an ongoing work group because this is kind of a complicated area. What I understood.
Chair Holvey and Representative Kinnemer, yes, of course. In the interim, my team will be pulling together a work group of all interested parties. Yeah, I foresee that this will be, there'll be a lot of stakeholder work on this. Yeah.
And second question, Mr. Chair. There were quite a diverse number of people involved in all of this, and is it safe to assume that this Dash 4 represents a consensus amendment?
Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnemer, with the caveat that it was dropped around 11:30 today, yes, I believe so. I think we are at a good place. The Debt Buyers Association, however, I think may have some issues remaining with the bill. We did sit down and talk with them a number of times to see if we could find some middle ground. But I can tell you, as of right now, we have a tentative, of course, with the caveat that it was dropped at 11:30 today, we have a tentative affirmation from the debt collectors and Encore, one of the biggest debt buyers, as well as the consumer groups and government groups.
Representative Fee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would love just a very quick, what are the biggest differences between the original bill and the Dash 4 that you see, and how, just a quick overview of the process for how you got from the original bill to the Dash 4.
12 hours.
I mean,
go ahead.
Okay,
give
40
it a
seconds.
Shot.
All right. Chairman, Representative Fahey. I mean, this is a bill that's probably been in the works for a few sessions already. So where we started this round, and I'm trying to remember back to the original bill, it's been a while. I think in the original one, we had all that information that needs to be sort of sworn to in the affidavit. We had that at the beginning of the lawsuit and at the end of the lawsuit, that those documents actually be attached. After talking with a number of stakeholders, since, you know, they do try to do these filings in an efficient manner, having them at both stages was potentially going to be problematic. There was also a concern raised regarding, as Rick mentioned, some of this information can be very personal, confidential information, financial information. So putting out a whole bunch of that information out in open court was also a concern. So we addressed that. There were a number of negotiations around the QRNS that I mentioned. Q started out as just don't collect on OHP debt ever. Well, we needed to put some caveats on there about, well, if you have an assurance from a hospital saying that it was not covered, that be in there. We also had to put an exception in for government as well. Sometimes we collect against Medicaid fraud. So technically that would be debt that's covered by Medicaid but shouldn't have been, so we wanted to be able to go after those cases. We also negotiated over a number of other issues, but I think those are probably some of the bigger ones.
Yeah. And I think the gateway between the agencies was also something that wasn't in the original bill that was pretty important, so that the debt buyers aren't getting, dual regulation sort of at the same time from two different agencies.
Okay, which is a very quick follow-up. So on page 10, line 29 and 30, that's the list of the business records. One of the things that I noticed was that seemed to be a major objection of the debt buyers was this part about the interest fees and charges that the original creditor imposed if, and now it says if the debt buyer or debt collector knows the amount. So that was just a change that caught my eye. I assume that was made because of conversations with the debt buyers. And
sure, I'll be Representative Fahey. That's correct. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you. I just can't tell you how much I appreciate all the work that's gone into this and all the stakeholders. I don't know if any other stakeholders want to say anything. They don't need to. Thank you.
That's it.
But I really want to thank all of the parties involved that really sat down, did a lot of work on this to get it in the shape where people can agree to it. So thank you so much. So with that, we're missing a member or two. Yeah, I'm just going to adopt the amendment, so it's...
Go get it.
Well, let's talk about adopting the dashboard to... Representative Bynum.
Okay. Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the -4 amendments to House Bill 2356.
Representative Bynum moves to adopt the -4 amendments to House Bill 2356. Is there discussion? Representative Evans.
I'd just like to say I appreciate all the efforts to make sure that the language is clear. I know it was a little bit of an additional pain at the end, so I appreciate it.
We appreciate your pain. So is there got a motion on the table? Is there any objection to adopting the -4 amendment? Seeing none, the -4 is adopted. We won't be moving this bill today, so I will close the work session on House Bill 2356. And let's open a work session on House Bill 3060.
Committee members, this is a measure brought to you by Representative Leiner, Nose, Sanchez, Alonso Leon, and Power. The measure was heard by the committee March 20th and March 22nd. It requires every public contractor to include as a material term that the contractor certifies that they have a policy and practice to prevent sexual harassment, sexual assault, and discrimination against members of protected classes. It prohibits state contracting agency from entering into a public contract when the anticipated price will be more than $150,000. When that contractor has not certified in writing that they have that policy or practice. And it specifies minimum requirements of the policy and practice, becomes operative January 1, 2018. And you now have the -4 amendment. It redefines some terms. It clarifies that the policy and practice, maybe Representative Leininger wants to talk about her amendment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Representative Leininger, would you like to take over from here and explain the -4 amendments to us?
Okay. Go ahead and say that, and then I will jump in. Thanks.
Okay, so in addition to some changes in definition, it clarifies that the policy and practice has to include a prohibition against discrimination in providing benefits to the employee or the employee's dependents when it's based on a protected class of the employee or their dependents. Further, it adds that the policy and practice has to include a prohibition on denying benefits to the employee or their dependents based on gender identity if the prospective contractor provides health care insurance or health care benefits. It also eliminates the requirement that the prospective contractor include with the bid or the proposal a written assurance that they have that policy or practice. And it allows the contractor to provide that in writing through an employee handbook, and it allows DAS, that's the Department of Administrative Services, to develop and make available a template to help those employer contractors, and for DAS to provide other guidance that would be helpful to the prospective contractor in meeting the requirements. Further, it requires only state contracting agencies, so not local governments or schools, the only contracting state agencies on contracts exceeding $150,000 to require that the contract include that material term that they will not, include the material term that they certify that the policy and practice will be maintained throughout the entire term of the contract. And finally, it expands exceptions for state agencies to enter into a contract with a contractor that has not provided the certification. Expands exceptions for the state agency to enter into contract with a contractor that's not provided certification that the policy and practice exists.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee.
For the record, your name?
For the record, I'm Ann Leininger of Lake Oswego, representing Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland. The amendments that you have before you, I really appreciate the chance to talk to you about this bill. Again, the bill is intended to help prevent discrimination and harassment based on gender and other protected class status by directing that when the state of Oregon uses its power of the purse to contract for goods and services at a value of over $150,000, the contracting party has to certify that they have in place these basic protections. We came to you before and had a lot of good conversation from both proponents and some concerns from opponents about the bill, and the Dash 4 amendment is the product of a work group that resulted in a consensus outcome and participates in the work group. And my understanding is there's now consensus on the bill. Participants in the work group included Betsy Earls from AOI, to whom I want to give a great shout out of thanks, and Drew Hagedorn representing AGC, and Kirsten, whose last name I don't have written down here, but who also is with AGC, has provided good input on this process. Our goal in the work group, and so has Lindsay Baker with the Department of Administrative Services and one of her colleagues there, the goal was to provide some clarification in the amendment to help ease compliance on the part of those who would be seeking these contracts, and I think we achieved that goal. A couple of the key points to describe them, just using a layperson's words, were that there would be a template essentially provided that would constitute the kind of language you need to give to your employees in order to have satisfied this notice requirement, saying, hey, you know, discrimination is not tolerated here, so here is, you know, here's what we don't allow. You need to report it to a supervisor, a designated person, if you experience, so that we can put a stop to it. There will be no retaliation if you report, or if you're a witness and you report. And we don't discriminate in provision of benefits. So there was a template provided. There was also express direction that if you have an employee handbook that has kind of the equivalent of that type of language, that satisfies the requirement. If you don't have the policy in place at the time you seek the contract, that's okay, provided by the time you execute the contract with the state, you have it in place. So that was an important clarification that the potential private contracting parties sought, very reasonable. And I don't know if Ms. Earls is intending to come up and speak to it, but I think this is an example of some good teamwork among people who came to the issue with a range of views, but were seeking in good faith to get to a mutually acceptable outcome, and I believe that that's where we have arrived at. So my intention today is simply to say, still important. This is still a manageable and simple bill to put in place policies to try to prevent discrimination on the front end by helping everyone know that it's not allowed in a given employer's operation, and do it in a way that's clear enough that folks can comply with relative ease, and we can all get the job done that I think all of us are trying to get done. That's
Thank
all.
You. I appreciated your layperson version.
Yeah. That was very helpful to me.
To the lay people.
Our questions. Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two small questions. Sure. Thank you, Representative, for coming. So did I understand it correctly that the Dash 4 does include the section where I'm looking under some of my notes, and in the Dash 2 it talks about provides exceptions for state agencies to enter into a contract with a contract that is not, or contractor with a contract, I can't say this. What I'm getting at is if they don't have the policy in place at the time of bid, when the bids are being awarded, just because they don't have it, they're not going to get kicked out. They will be allowed to get it in place, correct, so we don't lose the best value bid?
Chair Holby and Representative Hurd, yes. And I will acknowledge that I don't have the materials in front of me, so I apologize for that. But the intention was, and I think perhaps we were addressing input that you provided, the intention was to make sure that a group that might not have perfectly got that in place at the time of bid not be boxed out by transitioning the requirement to having it for sure be in place in an appropriate form at the point of executing the contract. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Second question is, in the Dash 4, I believe it calls out specifying written notice must be provided to each employee. Is that, how often is that? When is that to be issued?
Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd,
my goal with that was to ensure that rather than having it just be posted above the photocopier, which is something that maybe doesn't provide as much meaningful notice to people. As a person who's worked in workplaces that have stuff posted, you know, I think I've gone entire professional careers at a place and not really ever noticed what was posted above the copier. The intention was that people be affirmatively given the policy. Often that happens at onboarding, you know, when you get your employee handbook or you get the policies of the company, so that people, workers at a company, managers at a company, are affirmatively told, hey, in our business, we don't tolerate harassment or discrimination. If you see it or experiencing it, you know, here's who you report to. Won't be any retaliation for reporting. And we also don't discriminate in benefits. And that by through the act of affirmatively telling each employee, and my intention was, I'll finish the first thought. Through the act of affirmatively and telling employees that that doesn't fly here, we can head off some unfortunate conduct before it happens. And so I think that the kind of individual provision of the information is important. And I would say, you know, at a reasonable frequency, certainly no more than once a year, but probably at the frequency, you know, at onboarding, I think is a good idea. But I think that it could be that we don't specify that and it's left in the reasonable judgment of the employer.
Thank you. Appreciate you walking through that with us. It's helpful.
And thank you for the good comments from the committee. I think we were able to make some improvements based on those good comments. Thank you.
Let's go ahead and make a motion on the dash four on House Bill 36.
Dash 4. Yeah. Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3060.
Representative Bynum moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3060. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Dash 4 is adopted. And let's stand at ease for just a minute or two. Concert. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor back to order, and we are in a current work session on House Bill 3060. We've adopted the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 3060. I'm going to take a motion on the bill, please. Okay. Representative Bynum.
3060. Chair Holvey, I move 3060 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bynum moves House Bill 3060 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be voting yes on this bill, and I appreciate the intent behind it. To kind of reiterate what I said about a previous bill that I did vote no on, I have deep concerns about the potential blowback financially for the state of Oregon eventually on these projects that are connected and the services connected to these contracts. If we continue to go down the road of layer after layer after layer of basically saying what's illegal is more illegal and continue to stack the paperwork up that comes with every single contract for a potential contractor that does business with the state of Oregon, we're going to continue to see a reduction in the amount of contractors who are willing to deal with the paperwork and liability burden that comes with doing business with us. And at some point, we're going to regret, I think, the 20, 30 layers we put on every single issue like this, and it's going to hurt at some point. But I will be yes, because I do support the intent behind the bill.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also support the intent behind the bill. I realize the motivation, but like Representative Hurd, I think these are more requirements, more mandates, and more opportunity for litigation against employers. So I'll be a no.
Thank you. Kayla, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Doherty.
Aye.
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative Mankey.
Aye.
Excused.
Representative
Hurd.
Aye.
Representative Penimer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto.
No.
Vice Chair Bynum.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Aye. House Bill 3060, having received the votes, is passed. And we'll have Representative Leininger carry that on the floor. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3060. And we will open a work session on House Bill 2562.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is the bill from Representative Witt. You heard it way back on February 8th. It requires lenders for reverse mortgage to annually send the notice, send a notice to the borrower that informs them that they are still responsible for paying property taxes, insurance, maintenance, and related taxes, and that a failure to pay can cause a reverse mortgage to become due immediately. Provides that the notice must be provided every year, at least 60 days prior to when property taxes are due. Representative Witt worked on an amendment. He provided the Dash 3 amendment. It specifies that the annual notice regarding responsibility to pay property taxes has to be sent to the borrower or to the escrow agent, title insurance company, or other agent that pays the property taxes from an escrow account. Also exempts from the annual notice requirement when there is a reserve account for taxes and financial institutions that are defined in ORS 706-008. Those would be financial institutions under the Bank Act, as well as licensed consumer finance lenders. So those wouldn't be exempt from providing that, from the requirement to provide the notice. And then finally, it removes an exemption that mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers have currently from providing the specified information in any of their communications, solicitations, or advertisements for reverse mortgage contracts. On the Dash 3, there's no expenditure impact and there is no revenue impact.
So, and it doesn't appear that Representative Witt is here to speak on the bill, on the amendment?
No.
Was he going to be?
Did not hear from him.
Here. Mr. Cosgrove, would you care to speak to this at all? I know that you worked with Representative Witt a bit on this. I appreciate you filling in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Maybe.
Paul Cosgrove, representing Oregon Bankers and Oregon Financial Services, a very poor substitute for Representative Witt. We appreciate Representative Witt working with us. The big issue that is dealt with in the amendment, and I just wanted to point out because it's relatively new, is now federal regulations that govern all reverse mortgages in the country require if a borrower is apparently unwilling or unable. I love that, unwilling. Are you unwilling to pay your taxes? It's a strange term, but that's the federal term. In any case, if they're unable based on evaluation of their finances, the lender may not do a reverse mortgage without one of these reserve accounts. So we wanted to make sure that this notice did not go to those people because they would be confused. In fact, their taxes are going to be taken care of through a reserve account. So that's the major thing the amendment does, and we appreciate that. I think it'll work better and avoid some confusion for consumers.
Thank you. I appreciate you working with him to get those details. I know
thank
they're
you.
Oftentimes sticky.
Thank you.
So let's go ahead and have a motion to adopt the Dash 3 amendment.
Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2562.
Representative Bynum moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2562. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? The amendment is adopted. And this one is ready to move, so we can go ahead and have a motion.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2562 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bynum moves House Bill 2562 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Hurd.
It's a great bill. I really love what Rep. Witt brought to the table. So,
other discussion? Seeing none, Kayla, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Beatty?
Aye.
Representative Pack?
Excused.
Representative Hurd?
Yes.
Representative Penimer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2562 received the votes, is passed. And we'll have Representative Witt carry that bill. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2562. Let's open a...
You can adopt the amendment, but we don't have the...
All right. Let's go ahead and open a work session, House Bill 2567.
Mr. Chair and committee members, another bill from Representative Witt. You heard this back March 20th. This is about the WARN Act, the Worker Adjustment Retraining Notification Act. The measure requires that employers with 75 or more employees provide a 60 days notice to the employees as well as some government officials before ceasing operations, relocating or laying off 50 or more employees. And it creates exceptions. It requires the employer to provide documentation to the court or BOLI when invoking an exception involving the active pursuit of capital or business. And it provides a private right of action and holds the employer liable for back pay, benefits, and compensatory damages. Representative Witt brought forward a Dash amendment recently. It raises the threshold for when the provisions apply to employers from 75 employees, and he raises that to 100 employees. It eliminates the compensatory damages as a remedy in civil actions. There is no revenue impact, but we are waiting to hear from the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Very well. So we'll have a motion to adopt the Dash one amendment.
Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the Dash one amendment to House Bill 2567.
Representative Bynum moves to adopt the Dash one amendment to House Bill 2567. Is there discussion? Is there any objection to adopting the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment's adopted. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2567. Thank you. I don't have anything left to do.
You just announce your carryovers.
Okay. So after today, we will be carrying over House Bill 3170. Carry over House Bill 3264. Carry over House Bill 3402. We will carry over House Bill 3209. Carry over House Bill 2857. We will carry over House Bill 2169. We will carry over House Bill 2975. Carry over House Bill 2191. We will carry over House Bill 2348. We'll carry over House Bill 2356. We'll carry over House Bill 2567.
Mm-hmm. If you want to make that Monday, she would prefer that. You just say we'll schedule it.
Mm-hmm. So all of these bills will be carried over to Friday, except for House Bill 3209, which will go to Monday. Mm-hmm. With that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. Thank you. The House Committee on Business and Labor.